Okay, I think that's most of it for the time being. I'm going to assume that people generally, everybody's taken a quantum field theory course, and I guess the standard model course. I'm guessing that's a fair assumption. And just to give you fair warning, you're probably used to this. I'll do the usual Einstein summation convention. My flat space metric is going to be mostly minuses. So my apologies to all the relativists here, but this is sort of a particle physics convention. I'll use kind of standard natural units, but I will leave the Planck mass explicit. So sometimes people also set that to one. I won't. Okay, but I'm guessing all this stuff is fairly familiar. So I'll be speaking about physics beyond the standard model. And today I want to start off, I guess this is how these things always start, but I want to start off today by talking about why we think there's new physics beyond the standard model, trying to motivate the rest of the course. And okay, that's probably what I'll spend most of today on. But after that, I want to give it's a bit unusual, but I want to try to give you a feeling for how we think about quantum field theories. So a lot of what we're going to talk about will be based on quantum field theory. As you saw in the standard model course, quantum field theory is our basic fundamental tool for talking about the elementary particles that we all know and love that we've discovered. And the same thing goes typically for beyond the standard model. And I guess you've learned some quantum field theory. Quantum field theory is also something that takes a long time to really get an intuitive feel for. I want to try to give you a bit of an accelerated intuitive feel for how quantum field theories work and how we think about them in let's say, a modern way related to physics beyond the standard model. But first of all, let me get back to motivation. Why do we think there's new physics beyond the standard model? And the first thing, and this should be pretty obvious, is the standard model defined rigidly doesn't have gravity. And we know gravity is here. And we want to describe that in a quantum mechanical way in the same way that we describe all the other forces described by the standard model. So as far as talking about the particle physics that we tend to measure in the lab, we can mostly ignore gravity. So this is why we've gotten away with not putting gravity into the standard model so far. The reason is that gravity is just really, really weak. And because gravity is so weak, it tends to be unimportant for most of our, let's say, lab-based particle physics experiments. That's not quite true, but for the most part, we can get away with that. And the weakness of gravity is characterized by the size of Newton's constant, which in these nice natural units, I'm going to rewrite it in a suggestive way, 1 over 8 pi m Planck squared. And I do all the conversions, I find this particular number in natural units, in units of a GeV. Okay, so this is fine. And this m Planck corresponds to at least the reduced Planck mass that I'm going to use, which is about 2.4 times 10 to the 18 GeV. And this Newton's constant is a thing that you stick in when you talk about the force of gravity, like mm, gn, r squared, yada, yada, yada. So to give you some perspective on this, let me write down the corresponding thing for the weak interaction, at least at low energy. So by low energies, in this case, I mean below about 100 GeV. So the corresponding thing for the weak force is a so-called Fermi constant. And this thing, if I have it right, 1.16637 times 10 to the minus 5 GeV to the minus 2. So you may have seen this in your standard model course, but I just want to write it down explicitly to show you that this is much, much bigger than this. And that essentially characterizes the weakness of gravity. I see over 30 orders of magnitude here for gravity, even compared to the thing that we call the weak force that tends to be much weaker than other things. And this object, in terms of standard model stuff, turns out to be root 2 gsw squared over 8 mw squared. So in terms of the stuff that you saw in the standard model course, This combination comes up in a lot of amplitudes for the weak force at low energy. And it's related to the more fundamental stuff in the weak force through the corresponding SE2 gauge coupling and the W mass. So in any case, this is a much bigger number than this. And gravity is very, very weak.
Question?
Yeah.
So are we compared both of these at 100 GeV? Or what's the, is there a relevant energy scale for the gravity?
So good question. So this is let's say below 100 GeV, but even if you go much much above 100 GeV, as long as we stay well below this, this stays same ballpark. Okay, so we don't have gravity in the standard model, but gravity is really weak, so we've been able to sort of sweep that under the rug and not worry about it. But in principle, we want to describe gravity in the same way that we describe the other forces. And that leads us to trying to write down a quantum theory of gravity, which I actually will write down a quantum theory of gravity. The problem with quantum theories of gravity isn't that we don't have a quantum theory of gravity. It's that we don't have a quantum theory of gravity that works up to very high energies. So I'm going to be bold and write down a quantum theory of gravity right off the bat. And for this quantum theory of gravity, it'll be a little bit simplified. But for the quantum theory of gravity, if you think back to, let's say, describing other elementary particles, you write down an action that depends on some fields. And you apply quantum mechanics to it, and you do your quantum field theory stuff, and go to town. And the way you tend to define your quantum field theories is interpretive an action. So it turns out that we know the classical action for general relativity in much the same way that we know the classical action for electromagnetism. And in the case of electromagnetism, we identified the fields going to that action with photon fields, and we applied quantum field theory to it, and we went off and did our thing and derived QED. Let's try to do something similar for gravity. So in the case of gravity, our dynamical field is a metric. And I don't want to be overly ambitious, so instead of trying to do everything dynamically, I'm just going to assume I have a fixed flat background. So let's look at gravity in terms of small fluctuations around a flat background. So A to mu nu is my flat background. This is some general metric that depends on space-time. And let's write this as a background piece plus a fluctuation that depends on space-time. So sorry about this. So here's my full metric. Here's my fixed background. And here are small fluctuations around the background. And we're going to apply quantum mechanics to it. And we write down our standard Einstein-Hilbert action. And our standard Einstein-Hilbert action expanded to include gravity is just that. So I should say properly, the first piece is the Einstein-Hilbert action. This is our reduced Planck mass that I luckily wrote down back here. Let me get out of the way so you can actually see this. This is the Ricci scalar constructed out of this metric. But now the way I'm thinking about it is as an expansion in these small fluctuations around the flat background. In the sense that if I take this, I expand in these small fluctuations, it's going to turn out that I'm going to get things that look like kinetic terms with two derivatives, with a derivative acting on h squared. And I can interpret this as, or I can apply my same old quantum field theory techniques and derive a quantum field theory for this h mu nu field. And this gives me a nice, this actually gives me a theory of quantum gravity. It's a theory of quantum gravity coupled to the standard model. So the standard model coupling comes from two places. The first is that I have this factor of the metric here. So this is the determinant of the metric, square root. Again, you've probably seen this in a GR course. And then when I expand this out, I'm going to get powers of this h mu nu here. And the other thing is when I write L standard model of g, this means that when I have things like kinetic terms where I contract up indices, I contract them up with the full metric. So in other words, my kinetic terms are going to look like g mu nu, let's say for a scalar field. Well, my scalar field in the center model is the Higgs. I'll contract up stuff with my full metric, and this will also give me another coupling of this HMU new field, this fluctuation field, to my standard model stuff. So I claim that this gives me a well-defined quantum theory of gravity. I won't prove this, but it does. And you can actually go and compute amplitudes for the scattering of these objects. So these objects are what we identify with spin 2 gravitons. The theory has a gauge invariance in the sense that it's gauge invariance under local coordinate transformations. There's a redundancy in the description, in the same way that gauge invariance in standard gauge theories represents a redundance. And this gives me my quantum theory of gravity. Unfortunately, this quantum theory of gravity has two shortcomings. The first shortcoming is that I was forced to expand around a fixed background. And in general, I would like my quantum theory of gravity to do things like take matter and tell me what my background should be in a dynamical way. But there's another, let's say, more pressing quantum field theory problem, and that is that when I expand all this stuff out, and you'll notice here that my graviton field, so this is my spin 2 graviton field, when I expand this out, I get inverse powers of the Planck scale. And for example, when I go and couple to the standard model, I'll find that I get couplings that look like this, plus higher order things, plus graviton self-couplings, where this T mu nu is the energy momentum tensor of the standard model, derived from the standard model Lagrangian. And you see that here I have an operator with inverse mass dimension. And you may have seen this, or you may not have seen it, but we'll get to it a little bit later. Whenever you have operators involving couplings with inverse mass dimension, the theory becomes not understandable. The theory becomes incalculable at energies approaching the scale of the inverse mass that's suppressing these operators. So this is a so-called higher dimensional operator. This thing, if you count the mass dimensions, has dimension 4. This thing has mass dimension 1. And that means that this thing has mass dimension minus 1, as it should. It's 1 over Planck mass. And in a general way, that I'll get to in a little bit, whenever you have these so-called higher dimensional operators, where you have to stick in inverse mass dimension couplings to make up the dimension of the full thing, the theory breaks down as the energies that you probe approach the scale that's suppressing these operators. Yeah?
Could you just reabsorb Planck mass to the definition of the metric?
I'll come back to this in a slightly different context. The thing is, to write a standard kinetic term for this, that ends up being a scalar field, you end up wanting it to be a mass dimension 1 object. So you're forced to put in a mass dimension thing, and the thing that gives you the right size of coupling to matter turns out to be the Planck mass. Yes?
So what about ghosts in this setup? Isn't this against Pauli theory of this spin 2 field? I mean, don't you generally also have ghosts? I mean, next to this one, we don't have a ghost?
I think you should be able to gauge those out. I could be wrong about this, but there does exist a well-defined semi-classical theory of gravity defined this way. Okay, in any case, my theory is going to break down at some scale, and I'm seeing that it's going to break down what's close to what seems to be my Planck scale, and because this is a very high energy scale, I can mostly not worry about this, and I can go and compute graviton coupling in a well-defined way through operators like this with a standard model, or this is going to define graviton self-interactions. So I can define a reasonable quantum theory of gravity that's valid up to a very high scale, but in principle, we want a quantum theory of gravity that is valid beyond there, or put another way, we want to understand what happens at the Planck scale. So there have been lots of attempts to write down quantum theories of gravity that do apply above the Planck scale. My own biased preference is string theory, but there are also a lot of other interesting approaches, and we don't know which one is correct. But a generic expectation, or a somewhat generic expectation, is that just based on dimensional grounds, because we're seeing this heavy mass scale come up, at least a naive generic expectation is that the quantum theory of gravity will include new states with masses on the order of the Planck scale. So this is already motivation for new stuff beyond what we've already put into the standard model. In this case, we've extended the standard model to include a graviton field. But it seems like to complete this, we also want new states coming in around the Planck scale. In the same way that if I go back and think about my weak interaction, at low energies, at low energies for the weak interaction, I don't have to put in explicit W or Z bosons. I can write down an effective so-called four fermion theory. I'll get to this in a second. But you see that I have this mass scale coming in these effective interactions. And specifically, I have my low energy weak interaction I can write in terms of operators of this form, where these are standard model fermions, and here's my Fermi constant. And this theory works as long as I'm well below the W mass. But I know from my experience with the weak force that this theory doesn't work very well approaching energies near 100 GeV. Instead, I have to put in the new dynamical degrees of freedom that appear there, and those happen to be the W and Z gauge bosons. So our naive expectation for gravity is something similar happens, but up at the Planck scale, and this is a very, very high energy. I'm going to mostly concentrate on things happening at somewhat lower energies, much closer to the weak scale. So I'm not going to say too much more about quantum theories of gravity or even this stuff. But it is good to have in the back of your mind that just a reasonable naive expectation for quantum gravity, for a theory of gravity valid above the Planck scale, is that there should be new states with masses near the Planck mass. So again, you should have this 10 to the 18 GeV scale as sort of an upper limit, as sort of a maximal upper limit where your standard model description is going to work.
Is there any measurable quantity people actually see some good quantum gravity is useful? Like, does the theory we are proposing right now, or is there any experimental measurement which really requires that kind of calculation, quantum gravity and low energy?
Aside from this, viewed as an effective field theory, I'm not proposing any specific quantum theory of gravity, which means it turns out that if you take this and compute with it as an effective field theory, it reproduces essentially classical GR in the way you want it. When you start specifying what your completion is, what your quantum theory of gravity is, at that point you might get some observable consequences valid at energies below the Planck scale. So one thing that can come up is you can get funny dispersion relations for particles traveling over very, very long, very, very long cosmological distances. And some proposals for quantum theories of gravity have been constrained by seeing things coming from long distances traveling in essentially a fairly normal way. But the actual predictions are going to depend on the specific theories, and I'm not going to specify any. In general, life is difficult just because the Planck mass is so big. It means that the effective interaction is so small. So I don't want to say that it's not possible. And actually, later on, I'll give you some examples where quantum gravity stuff actually comes in at a much lower scale than you naively expect. But if everything is genuinely up at 10 to the 18 GeV, it's often difficult to test. But I don't want to say impossible, at least not without specifying a specific theory. Okay, so this is part one, quantum gravity. A second bit of motivation for physics beyond the standard model is a so-called electroweak hierarchy problem. And this is related to morally, it's related to this number being much bigger than Mw, that number. And to be more precise, recall from the standard model that we have a potential for the Higgs. So here's my Higgs field potential. Oh, it should be squared. And this Higgs field potential gives me my usual Higgs. This is V. And then I have electric symmetry breaking at the minimum of this potential. I'm going to call it V. V is about 174 GeV. And we write this as so-called vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field. And depending on how I choose my gauge, I can choose a so-called unitary gauge, where I expand my Higgs field around this background in terms of a real scalar. So this is my Higgs field. This is a real scalar field that I identify with the Higgs boson excitation that we recently found. And we know observationally that the value of this minimum for the Higgs field lies at about 200 GeV. Just as a word of warning, sometimes people define this with a root 2 built in. So sometimes you also see 246. So if you see 246 instead of 174, that just means that they define this with an extra root 2 compared to what I've done. But the root 2 is motivated by this normalization. OK. So we have this. And in terms of the potential, you can also show that compute the mass of this physical excitation. I guess I'm assuming you did this in the standard model course. And you get the mass of the physical gauge boson to be roughly 2 lambda v squared, which just turns out to be 2 mu squared when I impose the minimization condition. And this is observed to be about 125 GeV. So because I know the value of V, and because I know the value of the Higgs mass, I can fix all the parameters of the potential. So I know that this is some dimensionful parameter with on the order of 100 GeV or so. And this is a dimensionless coupling. It's about 0.2 or so. In any case, because we've discovered the Higgs, and because we've tested the weak interaction very precisely, we can fix everything in this potential. The puzzle with this, though, is that if you look at the full standard model Lagrangian, the only place in the standard model Lagrangian that has an explicit dimensionful scale built in is right here. So this turns out to be the only dimensionful piece of the standard model Lagrangian. And this is a little bit unfortunate. It's coming in with a scalar field. And scalar fields turn out to be very, very sensitive to quantum corrections. So I'm trying to figure out where to draw. Maybe I'll just go over here so I don't get stuck behind the lectern. So scalar fields turn out to be very sensitive to quantum corrections. And to give you an example, suppose we have a new fermion. Suppose there exists a new fermion, I'll call it psi. So it's some new fermion beyond the fermions we discovered in the standard model. And suppose it has a mass, m psi. And suppose it couples a coupling of the Higgs of y psi. So if I go off and I compute its effect on mu squared, what I find is delta mu psi squared is, I believe it's plus. OK, well, I'll put a squiggly here, but I think it's a plus sign, y psi squared over 4 pi squared m psi squared. So this is going to come from a quantum correction to the Higgs two-point function. So here I have a Higgs field. Here I have a Higgs field. And then here's my fermion loop. And that means I get a y psi here, a y psi here. I have a loop. After I renormalize the loop, so it's formally divergent, I renormalize it in the usual way, but I have a finite leftover piece. The finite leftover piece, it turns out to go quadratically like the mass of the fermion in the loop, and proportional to y psi from these two vertices. And the 1 over 4 pi squared is what you typically get from loops. So I have a squiggle here because there are other over 1 numbers, but they don't matter for this argument. So the puzzle here is, the issue here is, suppose there exists some new heavy fermion that's a fair bit heavier than anything in the standard model. And by a fair bit heavier than the standard model, I mean much, much heavier than 100 GeV. Unless this coupling is really small, this coupling, this correction to the mu parameter, this correction to the mu term in my Higgs Lagrangian is really, really big. And the hierarchy problem is just that scalar fields are unique in that their mass terms, these dimensional mass terms, are quadratically sensitive to new stuff beyond the standard model at energies well above the standard model scale. And the fact that I observe a value of mu, so the value of mu here in the potential to get everything right is about 100 GeV. It seems kind of funny to have quantum corrections to this value of mu that are many, many orders of magnitude larger than what I actually observe. And it would seem to require some sort of cancellation. And just to give you an example of one kind of thing that could come in to give you this sort of correction, right up here I mentioned that our naive expectation for quantum theories of gravity is that they contain new states with masses on the order of the Planck mass, 10 to the 18 GeV. A second generic expectation is that you should either have a lot of them or they should couple in order one way to standard model stuff. And that means that our very naive quantum gravity expectation is that our complete quantum theory of gravity will give us stuff with masses on the order of the Planck mass and couplings on the order of one, at least once you figure in a possible multiplicity of lots of stuff. So far I've done this for a fermion. So I'll put a little firm here to say that this is a correction from a heavy fermion. I could do the same thing for a heavy boson. And it turns out that for heavy boson, I'll call the heavy boson phi. It turns out the correction from a heavy boson goes like y phi over 4 pi squared times the mass squared of that heavy boson. And here it comes in with an opposite sign. And I have one power of the coupling here. And again, the correction is again quadratically sensitive to the mass of the new thing. You'll notice that here I have a plus sign and here I have a minus sign. And you might hope, maybe I could have new fermions and new bosons coming in such a way that these cancel out. And it turns out that this is what we're going to do with supersymmetry down the road. Supersymmetry is going to, in fact, enforce that these couplings are equal for particles versus their superpartners, and the signs will give you a cancellation. So we'll get to this later. But in general, if these are uncorrelated and these are different things, either this correction or this correction is going to be much bigger, or can be much bigger than the thing I want to be 100 GeV. So the big puzzle is, if I have stuff in my theory, anything in my theory that's much heavier than the standard model scale of 100 GeV, it's going to typically destabilize the Higgs potential. If I think about the effect of making this mass parameter much bigger than 100 GeV, what's going to happen is if the corrections turn this positive, then my minimum is at the origin. I don't get a Higgs bev. I don't get electric symmetry breaking. If they make this thing much, much more negative, then it makes my bev go very big and all my vector bosons get very, very heavy. So either way, a big Higgs mass parameter is going to ruin the standard model, at least relative to what we observe. And we don't understand why that should be the case. So to give you an analogy, the electric hierarchy problem is like, suppose you walked into the room and you see a piece of chalk balancing. Actually, the chalk is a bad idea because I actually can balance it. But suppose I had a pencil, like a sharpened pencil, and you saw a pencil just balancing on its tip on a flat metal surface. So chances are it's not just balancing there by accident. Either somebody super glued it to the desk, or it has like wires holding it up or something. The situation for the standard model is similar. As far as we can see, it's like we just walked into the room, we see a pencil standing up on a flat surface with a sharpened tip, and, well, intuitively, that shouldn't be the case. So we expect that there's something holding it up to balance it one way or another, right? Whether it's super glue or just invisible or just very small wires or something else. And the electric hierarchy problem is essentially the idea that there should be some new kind of physics balancing the pencil, and we want to figure out what that new physics is. And if you think about the sizes of these things, if you want to make sure that the sizes of the quantum corrections to the Higgs mass parameter are not much bigger than the Higgs mass parameter, at least if these things should not be much larger than, let's say, order 100 GeV squared, that means that unless I have very small couplings, the masses of the new things coming in, unless they cancel in some way, shouldn't be much heavier than about loop factor times it shouldn't be too much heavier than a loop factor times the Higgs mass scale. So what I mean by this is so the Higgs mass scale is about 100 GeV. These loop factors give me roughly a 4 pi. And that means that if I'm going to have new stuff coming in to solve the hierarchy problem, to make sure that this stuff doesn't these quantum corrections don't destabilize the weak scale, it should come in at an energy that's not too high. So this is a motivation for new stuff at the TeV scale. And it just so happens that the TeV scale is exactly the thing we're probing right now at the LHC. So this is a big part. So I realize a lot of this is numerology, but it's numerology in a sense that we've always seen this before. So in the past, whenever we've seen what looks like a scalar field of nature, it's turned out to be natural in a sense along these lines. So to give you an example, a scalar field that we see in nature is a pion. A pion, pions are spin zero, and the pion mass is about 200 MeV. And if you look at pions, we know that pions aren't fundamental scalars. Pions are bound states between quarks and antiquarks. And if I only looked at pions, I see particles of mass of 200 MeV. But we know that the pions correspond to quark antiquark bound states, and the fundamental scale of QCD is about 1 GeV. So in the case of pions, or the QCD case, our expectation based on naturalness is that new stuff should come in with masses less than about 4 pi times the pion mass. And it turns out that this is about a GeV, and this is in fact what we see for QCD. So pions are a little bit of a cheat because they can be considered Goldstone bosons and they could potentially be much lighter, but I'll get to that later. But this is one example where scalar fields that we see in nature turn out to be natural in a quantum mechanical sense along these lines. So because we've always seen this before, we expect it to be the case here. If we don't see the case, if it does not turn out to be the case for the weak scale, something kind of funny has to be going on. And okay, it'd be disappointing not finding new stuff, but it would also tell us something very deep about how nature works. Yeah.
How do you get a TeV by dividing 100 GeV by 4 pi?
Oh, sorry, you don't. Sorry. What I mean here is this is the new thing.
Right.
So yeah, the 4 pi should be over here, and okay, I just can't do algebra. Yeah, but you're correct. Okay, but yeah. So our expectation for new canceling stuff or new things is it should come in near a TeV. So again, the TeV here is a bit fuzzy, but you get the idea. So this is the electroweak hierarchy problem, and there's a lot of optimism that we're going to find stuff, new stuff at the LHC to fix it up. Let me just mention very quickly three classes of solutions. We'll see in more detail down the road.
A mass question.
Sure.
This Higgs mass is actually measured in the accelerator, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but usually the formula, the square root of 2 lambda b squared, is based on the tree level calculation without adding any quantum correction. So, like, what if that formula is just wrong? And, how can we guarantee that 125 GeV can be explained with the pre-level calculation? What if we have to include quantum correction in the first place?
Okay. Yeah. So I'll come back to that. So actually, that will get to the next thing I'll talk about. But it has to do with the renormalizability of the theory. So the quantum corrections can all be lumped So I can think of this as my tree-level potential, but I can also think of this as an effective potential computed after lumping all the quantum corrections back into it. So there's a sense in which I can think of this as a quantum corrected potential, where I've folded in all the quantum corrections into the values of these parameters. And the thing I'm minimizing is actually that quantum corrected potential rather than the tree-level potential. But it turns out that the quantum corrected potential basically takes the same form, and the same formula goes through. So there are small controllable corrections to this, but this is still the main story. But I'll come back to that and try to motivate in more detail. Yes.
So you said that in that potential, the problem is that that's a dimensionless parameter with the Higgs, the mu squared term.
Yes.
Why is this problem specific to the Higgs then? I mean.
Yeah. So this is something I'll also get to. When I try to get to, let's say, intuitive quantum field theory. So the thing with the Higgs is that this is just an H squared, and there's no symmetry I can write down to forbid correction. So there's no enhanced symmetry for pretty good approximation as I vary this. Whereas it turns out that a mass for a vector field, I can force that to go to zero through gauge invariance. And the mass for fermions, it turns out that fermion masses automatically violate what's called a chiral symmetry. I'll show that explicitly down the road. But it turns out the scalars are very special in that sense, and that you don't have the other stuff. In a sense, spin lets you push masses to be small, whereas there's no spin way to push masses small here. So I'll talk about this down the road. It's a good question. And it is what makes scalar fields unique, and it is why we worry about the Higgs. And we don't worry about, let's say, the electron mass being half an MeV. Okay, so very quickly, there are three classes of solutions to the hierarchy problem. The first class involves a cancellation of quantum corrections. And a classic example of this is supersymmetry. And what happens in supersymmetry is supersymmetry relates fermions and bosons. And in the limit of exact supersymmetry, whenever you have a new fermion coming in, it gives you a correction like this. It forces you to have a new boson coming in that gives you a correction like this, with a coupling here that matches up the coupling here. And since these loops come in with different signs, this thing cancels against this, and this big correction goes to zero. So now we know that supersymmetry isn't exact. If you had exact supersymmetry, for every electron, you'd have a bosonic superparticle with the same mass. And we definitely don't see that. But we can have approximate supersymmetry. And what I mean by that is everything is still supersymmetric. Every particle still has a superpartner. But the particles and the superpartners are split a little bit in mass. And the amount that you split them in mass corresponds to the extent to which these corrections don't completely cancel. So one possibility for supersymmetry is that you have approximate supersymmetry, where you have new stuff that might be very heavy, but the splittings between the fermions and the bosons related by supersymmetry are relatively small compared to the weak scale, and the size of these corrections are under control. So I'll talk more about this down the road. But supersymmetry, the idea is you get a cancellation enforced by these opposite signs in the loop. The second possibility is our description of a Higgs field changes radically a little bit above the weak scale. So what I mean by this is a classic example of this is maybe the Higgs boson isn't a fundamental scalar. Maybe it's a bound state. Maybe it's a bound state of, well, not the regular QCD quarks, but maybe there are new quark-like objects interacting under some new new force that's a little bit like a strong force. And maybe the Higgs is a composite made of these more fundamental objects that aren't bosons. So in this case, instead of having a scalar field that is very sensitive to quantum corrections, it might just be a bound state of some, let's say, fermions that don't have this strong quantum correction. This is a little bit like what happens with pions in QCD. And there's an interesting class of theories that describe this story. So I'll come back to this down the road as well. And the third case is maybe M star, which is what I'll call the fundamental Planck scale. Maybe it turns out that the actual fundamental scale of quantum gravity is way less than what we think it is. So I still have it up here, very good. What we think is the fundamental scale of quantum gravity is about this 10 to the 18 GeV, but maybe for one reason or another, the way we see gravity ends up being much weaker than what it actually is in a fundamental sense. So at this point, this probably sounds very cryptic, but it turns out that in theories of extra dimensions, in particular if these extra dimensions are large in a sense, this is a possibility. So at this point, all this stuff probably sounds very cryptic, but we'll see explicit examples of all these cases for solutions to the hierarchy problem based on one of these three classes of solutions. And as far as I know, okay, well, so for the most part, these are these are the three main ways people have tried to address the hierarchy problem. There's an interesting new idea called relaxation that I probably won't get into, but people are still trying to figure out whether this actually works. Okay, but in any case, I'm going to concentrate on, at least partly, on theories of new physics motivated by the hierarchy problem, and we'll see that they tend to fall into these classes. So the hierarchy problem is another piece of motivation for physics beyond the Standard Model. If you like, though, it's primarily a theoretical motivation. It's based on our theoretical intuition and past experience and our quantum sensitivity to corrections. But we also have experimental evidence for new stuff beyond the Standard Model, and that comes primarily from cosmology.
Why don't you just let the mass of X run by the quantum version? Like, why are you concerned about not making the Higgs mass run in a different sense?
I guess I'll come to that down the road. But we do know that because we've measured this quantity, it fixes the value of that. You can compute the of a normalization group running of dimensionless or dimensionful parameters and dimensionless parameters as well, and that normalization group running is typically logarithmic. So the running wouldn't be big enough to account for the quadratic sensitivity. Okay, I'll come back to that as well. Okay. But the hierarchy problem is a, let's say, primarily theoretical motivation for new physics beyond the Standard Model. We also have experimental motivation from cosmology. And the idea here is, suppose we go back to our Standard Model plus minimal quantum gravity theory. At energies much below the Planck scale, this looks very much like just the regular Standard Model plus general relativity. So if we take Standard Model plus general relativity and we apply it to the early universe, we are pretty sure that the early universe was very hot. So I'm going to write T as the temperature of the early universe, and this temperature will be time dependent in the sense that if you take the Standard Model and you put it, you make it into a thermal plasma and you put it into the early universe, you find that the early universe expands. And as it expands, the temperature of the plasma cools off. So our picture of the early universe, I'm guessing most of you have taken a cosmology course. So our picture is you have a very hot early universe. All the energy density of the Standard Model stuff in it causes it to expand. And as it expands, this plasma cools off. And as the plasma cools down, things happen. So if you start off really, really early at energies, let's say much above, let's say we start at energies much above a GeV. Above a GeV, we have a plasma of quarks and gluons, plus all the other standard model things. As you cool down below about a GeV, the quarks and gluons glomp into color neutral objects, into protons and neutrons and pions and so on. So that's called the QCD phase transition. As I cool further and further, around, I guess, a little bit below an MeV, individual protons and neutrons start to glomp together into light nuclei. This is called primordial nucleosynthesis. And as I keep on cooling and cooling and cooling, at temperatures of about on the order of an eV, it turns out it's actually about a 0.3 eV, protons and electrons combine to form neutral helium, neutral hydrogen. And at this point, it's called recombination. The universe becomes transparent to photons. So what I mean by this is that in a plasma with charged objects within it, a photon doesn't go very far before hitting something. Whereas once these charged objects glomp together into a neutral object, in this case neutral hydrogen, photons can travel much, much farther because they're much, much less likely to hit something. So it turns out that at temperatures below about 0.3 eV, photons were able to, for the most part, travel through the universe without hitting anything else. And as they travel along, their wavelength redshifts with the expansion of the universe, and they cool off. And the photons that we see left over from the so-called recombination epoch are what make up the cosmic microwave background today, the CMB. So today, we see these CMB photons. CMB photons with temperature on the order of about, I think it's about 2.73 Kelvin, so relatively cold. And the CMB photons essentially give us a snapshot of the universe when its temperature was much hotter at about 0.3 eV. A good mnemonic, just to keep in mind, is that room temperature, which is about order 300 Kelvin, is about 1/40th of an eV. So if you ever have to do a quick conversion, this is a handy thing. So room temperature is about 1/40th of an eV. In any case, today we're about 3 Kelvin. We see these leftover photons. And from the patterns of bumps and wiggles in the photons, we're able to learn a lot about the energy density content of the universe. And based on this and other cosmological probes, we get the standard pie chart that you've probably all seen a lot. And the pie chart tells us the relative contributions to the energy density of the universe today. So roughly 3/4 of the energy density of the universe today seems to be so-called dark energy. About 20% is dark matter. I'll just write dark energy. And the remaining 5% is stuff we know and love, is standard model things. And by mass, it's essentially all baryons. So by baryons, I mean protons or neutrons or things made of them. And then, okay, there's a little sliver for the photons left over. But this is much, much less than a fraction of a percent. You have like photons and neutrinos and so on. But this is just a tiny, tiny fraction. So it turns out that the standard model doesn't do a very good job explaining these pieces of energy content of the universe. And it does badly in different ways. So let me try to give you an idea of that. So dark energy, 75% is the biggest contributor. It turns out that this is actually easy to accommodate within the standard model, but it's hard to explain. So what I mean by this is an easy explanation for the dark energy is that our action for the universe is the same thing I had before, my d4x minus root g. I've got my m Planck squared over 2 I've got my Einstein-Hilbert piece. I've got my Alstander model of G. And here's the punchline. All I need to put in for dark energy is a so-called cosmological constant. In other words, I just add a constant piece to my Einstein-Hilbert plus standard model action. I just take in a constant. It's perfectly fine. In fact, I even expect quantum corrections to generate this. So good. I'm down with 75%. But there's still an issue with this. And the issue with this is a similar fine-tuning issue to the issue here. And that is that this cosmological constant, it has mass dimension of 4. So I'm going to take the 1/4 of power. And the observed value turns out to be about 2.5 times 10 to the minus 2. Sorry, 10 to the minus 12 GeV. And this is a very little number. So this is a very small number. Our standard model scale is more like 100 GeV. Our QCD scale is about 1 GeV. Since this has to do with gravity, a naive expectation is that the scale for this should be closer to the natural gravity scale, which would be more like the Planck scale. And if I compare the Planck scale to this, and I'm honest and I take 4 powers of it, because it's a dimension 4 object, I'm off by something like 124 orders of magnitude. So the thing with dark energy is we know how to account for it. We can just write down a cosmological constant in our Lagrangian. And this agrees with all the observations so far. And in fact, the observations seem to be narrowing down on this cosmological constant interpretation. The thing we don't understand, though, and the reason why it's hard to explain, is the number that corresponds to it is really, really small. And a more natural expectation is maybe something like the Planck scale or even 100 GeV. Even that would be too big. So this is the so-called dark energy problem. I'm not going to say much about it, but it is a big puzzle. One last thing regarding this. If our cosmological constant was much bigger than the value it had, what we see today, when we look at the energy density of the universe, we have dark matter being this, so it's a 1/4 fraction, dark energy being this 3/4 fraction. If you look at how these different contributions to the energy density change as the universe expands, it turns out that the matter content scales like the matter content scales like the expansion to the 3rd power. Radiation content scales like expansion rate to the 4th power. And the cosmological constant dilutes according to the expansion to the 0th power. So as the universe expands, the cosmological constant piece becomes more and more important. And what we're seeing now is a transition from matter and radiation domination to dark energy domination, to cosmological constant domination. OK, so much for dark energy. Dark matter is 25%. As far as dark matter goes, it corresponds to a matter content of the universe that is dark in the sense that it doesn't interact with photons enough for us to see it. On top of that, based on how it affects the CMB, and based on what we've seen with nucleosynthesis, we're pretty sure that the dark matter is also not any kind of baryonic thing. And if you think about stuff in the standard model that is neutral, non-baryonic, basically what you're left with is neutrinos. But all the neutrinos we know of are very light. So it seems like dark matter, if it's associated with particles, has to be some new kind of particle beyond what we've seen. And it turns out that this is our best explanation for what the dark matter is. Other proposals are maybe that gravity works in a slightly different way than we think it does. But I'd argue that the particle interpretation of dark matter tends to work much better. So I'm going to go with the picture that dark matter consists of some new particle beyond the standard model. Often people abbreviate beyond the standard model as BSM. And this new particle should be stable, or really long-lived. It should be neutral under electromagnetism plus the color gauge group. And it should be massive in the sense that it's non-relativistic, it's non-relativistic today and also going back in time. And it turns out that the condition for this is typically the mass of the thing has to be larger than about a keV.
Oh, what do you mean non-relativistic when you mention massive?
So in the early universe, if you have a particle of mass m, if the temperature is much bigger than the mass of the particle, the temperature corresponds to kind of a typical momentum of particles in the plasma. So if you put a particle of mass m in a plasma that's much hotter than it, all the scatterings with the particles in the plasma are going to quickly make your initially at rest particle into something that's moving around relativistically. So put another way, because a typical momentum of an object of a particle in the plasma is given by the temperature. If the temperature is much bigger than the mass, it ends up with a momentum much bigger than the mass, so it's relativistic. So the approximation is that particles in the cosmological plasma are relativistic until the temperature falls below their mass. Because otherwise their average momentum is much bigger than the mass. So what I mean by relativistic versus non-relativistic in the context of cosmology is particles that have masses larger than a given temperature. So we know that dark matter has to act like matter today, and that means it has to be non-relativistic today, and that means that its mass has to be larger than whatever energy scale corresponds to 2.73 Kelvin. But it turns out that the condition is actually a little bit stronger than that. The condition is actually mass larger than about a keV, otherwise what we're calling dark matter doesn't act like dark matter. It would have acted like radiation, for example, when the CMB was forming, or even a little bit earlier, in such a way that our universe today wouldn't look the way it does, unless the mass is above about a keV. Yes?
Why does it have to be color neutral?
Otherwise it would interact too much with the baryonic stuff, for one. So it would interact too much with protons and neutrons bouncing around, It turns out that you want the dark matter to essentially not scatter much with itself or with anything else. If it scatters too much with itself or anything else, it tends to stay clumped together with the baryons, and we know that doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So basically, unless it's color neutral, it's going to interact too much with the other stuff to act the way you want it to do for dark matter. Now, in principle, if you have objects that carry colored charge but are somehow very bound into very dense objects that don't interact much with baryons, that might be possible. But to at least to a first order, you don't want a colored charge. Yes?
If you consider the vacuum energy of the standard particle, does this picture change in a bit?
So the expectation for the cosmological constant just from competing loops with standard model particles ends up being on the order of 100 GeV. So even that's way too big. So even if I forget about this Planck scale business, even the standard model contribution is too big. So yeah, the cosmological constant is, we don't understand why the number is so small, and there are very few plausible explanations for it. So I think I'm out of time, so I'll wrap it up there. But tomorrow I'll wrap up motivation and then move on to, if you like, intuitive quantum field theory. So thanks. And if you have questions, yeah, email me or drop by my office. I'll mostly be around. So.